The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4 of this 7-day Sesshin here at Turtleback Zendo in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Already well past the halfway point, which actually happened very early this morning, of this Sesshin. And I'd like to share with you some other writings. Ever since the dawn of human beings, very likely people have wondered about existence. And there have been various different forms of this wondering. Some of it has gotten frozen in dogma. Actually, a lot of it has gotten frozen in dogma. And this is one of the things about Zen and Rinzai Zen in particular, is that dogma is not what is of concern to us. Our own personal experience of liberation, true liberation, freedom from this self-image, a deeper understanding of reality, a deepest understanding of reality, is vital. And that comes through personal experience, and it comes as a result of our meditation practice. The more we give ourselves completely to this meditation practice, the deeper we will go. And along the way, it may not seem as if we're going deep at all. As a matter of fact, it might seem as if we're going backwards. There is a point in the progress of our practice where we begin to see more clearly, and that involves not just a clear vision of enlightened mind, but it also involves a clear vision of our behavior. It's said that at the moment of our death, or shortly before the moment of our death, our whole life flashes before us in vivid technicolor, and we see more clearly than we've been able to see during our life how we have behaved. And that includes the places where we're caught in greed, anger, and delusion. I remember my grandmother used to always say, from quite early in age, of course I didn't know her until she was in her 50s, but I remember her forever saying, "I'm ready to be my maker." And every time she would say that, I would think, "Nope, grandmother, you're not quite ready yet." And then one day, many, many years later, when she was living in a retirement home, my grandfather had long since died, and she was in the more intensive care end of one of these 3-stage retirement homes, where you can go into independent living, and you can go into living that was supported, helped with a certain amount of care, and then you can go into more total care, which is really more like nursing care. And she was at that point. And all of a sudden, my uncle, her son, and his wife were called to meet with the people at the place where she was living. And the reason why was because she had been crying nonstop for a day and a half, and they could not figure out why. They'd ask her, and she just wouldn't say, or couldn't say, I don't know which. She was still cognitive at that point. And 6 months later she died, but when she did die, then she died peacefully. And I'm sure that what was happening to her behind those tears was that she was seeing her behavior in more clear light. And one of the things we do see is, like I said, where we're acting out of greed, anger, and delusion, which we hide from ourselves. We try to avoid feeling it, thinking it, seeing it. We have this overall self-image of somebody who's a particular way, maybe a negative particular way, but it's a It's usually a particular way, negative or not, where we feel like we're behaving appropriately and clearly and compassionately and with awareness. And as we do our practice, we go more and more clearly into our mind state and begin to see the sticky places there. And at this point in our practice, we can assume that something's wrong with our practice or that we're getting worse because of our practice. But in reality, it's more that our practice really is working. We're just seeing more clearly where we are caught. And that is actually an excellent point in practice if we are willing to take that ball and run with it. People have a lot of ideas about Zen practice, all kinds of marvelous ethereal ideas about Zen practice. And initially there's a honeymoon period where we're just learning how to cross our legs, what to do with our breath, our hands, etc., etc., etc. And we're caught up in those details and haven't really gotten into the practice per se. And then the honeymoon period ends, as one teacher friend of mine, a Zen teacher friend in the ZCLA lineages, said, the shit hits the fan. And we start focusing outward. We think that we are getting worse, or we think that somebody else is to blame for this problem that we're having. And it goes on and on. But, as I said, if we are willing to take that insight, that clearer seeing, which is what it really is, and use it as Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said, manure for our practice, fertilizer for our practice, then it can take us a long way towards liberation. And this is very important. This is part of the long maturation that Tore Enji was so concerned about, as part of practice, as an essential part of practice. Tore Enji was the Dharma successor, the first, I think, Dharma successor of the great Zen master Hakuin Eikaku, Japanese Zen master who single-handedly gave birth once more to Zen, Rinzai Zen in particular, in Japan. He resurrected it from the doldrums. It was a time when Buddhism had really decayed in Japan, and the priests and monks were much more concerned with appearance, with whether they had the fanciest kesa, which is the ceremonial robe, or the highest standing with the government and so on and so forth, than with real practice and coming to awakening. Here and there were others, like Dogen, like Ikkyu. They were at different eras. And Hakuin, other than his final teacher, Dokyo Eitan, was rare. In fact, probably the only Rinzai monk in Japan who was willing to stick it out to deepest insight. And deepest insight he did get. He wrote, and then this spanned decades of his life, that he had had 19 major Kensho experiences, enlightenment experiences, insights into the nature of reality, and countless minor insights. And this is a model for our practice, to keep going regardless. At any rate, Tore Enji, when he was 26 years old, had already had profound awakening, and became quite ill. There's some question about exactly what he was ill with. Possibility was it was TB. Another possibility it was the Japanese culture has a quality of striving about it. And Hakuin himself got to a point of the doctors giving up on his condition because he had gotten himself into such a stressed out state through his intense striving. And that brings up another concern, and that is that Zen practice is about opening to our inner deep curiosity, our need to know, that yearning to return to our true home, that deep need to know why there is suffering in the world, and certainly there is suffering in this world right now. It's not about driving ourselves into awakening. It's about opening to possibility and sinking deep down within our psyche. Opening, being so inwardly quiet that we will recognize when it appears to us the true nature of reality. So Tore Enji got so sick that the doctors gave up on him as well. And he decided that if he was going to die anyway, which of course we all are going to do, that he would record all that he had learned about Zen practice in case it might be of use to someone. And so for, I think it was 6 months, he rested and wrote whenever he had the energy to write, and gradually it became well. In fact, he lived to a fairly ripe old age. And when he was well enough, he let Hakuin know that he had written this treatise called The Treatise of the Inexhaustible Lamp. And you can get a copy of one translation of it by one of the Cleary brothers through Amazon.com. If you just, I think all you have to do is search for Tore Enji. There's another more magnificent translation that unfortunately is no longer in print that was done by Myokyo Ni, who was a Dharma successor in the lineage of, I think it was Daitokuji, but it might have been Nanzenji, one of the Rinzai headquarter temples. She's also dead, I believe. Her name was Irmgard Schlegel. She was a Westerner, she was a German, who went through her entire training, as I understand it, at that temple in Japan, and ended up being authorized to teach, I think, by Morinaga Soko Roshi. And she was a genuine article. She established the Zen Center in, I think it was London, it was in England at any rate, and along with a Japanese woman, translated not only Tore Enji's works, but also a commentary by a 20th century Rinzai master who gives a lot of insight into both the history and the background of what Tore Enji is describing. Unfortunately, I think those books are on sale through Amazon.com for about $500. If you can ever find one that is affordable to you, then by all means do so. Because the Cleary translation, while it's a very good translation, is only the translation of Tore Enji's words. It's not the translation with the commentary, which makes the book about twice as thick. One of the things that Tore Enji said about practice that he had realized is that there are stages of practice. You start out, of course, as a beginner, and then once you've had a significant enough insight, kensho, which literally means seeing into, to be able to work on subsequent koans, then it goes into what is he called the advanced practice, which is honing and expanding and deepening that initial awakening through working on the koans. And there are many, many, many koans. The traditional number, which I think in a certain way could represent infinity, is 1,700 koans that can be worked on to expand and deepen your insight, your awakening. But then he also pointed out that equally important is what he called the long maturation. The long maturation is exactly what can happen, hopefully will happen, when you gain these insights, whenever they come, and that doesn't have to be post-Kensho, it can be pre-Kensho for sure, when we get these insights into our behavior, a clearer vision of our thought, our speech, our actions, that make us wince. And there are ways of working on these that are a little bit more psychological, but that's fine. The important thing is for the 360 degree development of the human being. And that involves letting go our sticky places, as a longtime Zen friend of mine calls them. We see that, I didn't realize I was speaking with that tone of voice when I was talking to that person. And we feel remorse and regret at behaving like that, because we don't want to be like that. Nobody does. Then that offers an opportunity to let go the habit pattern of assumption and behavior that led to that behavior. It involves allowing ourselves to recognize and accept that we did not behave in the most exemplary way, to own it, to feel it in our body, and then after that, something amazing happens. The next time we would behave out of that habit pattern, it's almost like red flashing lights pop up, and right on the brink of engaging in it, it's like we step back a bit and we think, wait a minute, I don't want to do this anymore. And it's easy not to. Today, I'd like to again share with you some of the teachings that can point to awakening that are not within the Buddhist tradition. The deepest truth is identical regardless of the format of the expression of it. Within Christianity, within Islam, within just an open mind with no dogma at all, it can come forth awakening. One example of this is Flora Courtois, who was a contemporary American woman. She ended up living in Santa Barbara, California. She died about 10 years ago at this point, at a fairly advanced age. She was in her 70s. And when she was a college student at University of Michigan, right around the Great Depression, in fact, her first year of college was just before the crash. She had already, from the age of about 15, been questioning whether there was a truth, a profound truth, profound enough truth, I should say, underlying all existence, all experience, that was always true, regardless of circumstance. And this came about because, as a child, she used to keep a collection, a scrapbook of aphorisms. And every time there would be some occurrence of something or other, something would happen, she would run to her book of aphorisms to try to find the aphorism that fit that particular situation. And she began to realize fairly early on that while the situation was in place, the aphorism might fit, but as soon as the situation was over and she was in a different situation, that aphorism no longer fit. And that's what began to trigger her interest in trying to find something, some truth that was so deep that it was true regardless of what was going on at any particular time. And when she got into college, it somehow ramped up, the intensity of that quest ramped up. And so she began to take courses in psychology and philosophy and all manner of anything she felt might be related to that quest. She also, having been raised Roman Catholic, went to speak with the local parish priest who was, she wrote, a very popular young man with the college crowd. And he gave her a stack of books on Catholic dogma, Christian dogma, to read in response. And while she realized that the answers were not going to be in there, she read them dutifully, she said, and indeed the answers were not there. And so she continued to struggle with this question and somehow keep going. But after the market crashed, she was able to go back to further years at University of Michigan through a scholarship and through some, well, some aid that involved staying with a family that had young children off campus and working on some lighthouse work and taking care of the kids to pay for her room and board there. And she wrote that it took her forever to do even a tiny little bit of ironing, and everything had to be ironed back then. There was no permanent press. And because she was so absorbed in this questioning, and this is the fundamental source of awakening, is to be so absorbed in this need to know, in this curiosity, in this openness to possibility, that everything else can be let go of because the search is so strong. And now the search is going to wax and wane for us, and there are times when we would care less about whatever question we have, whether it's a koan or whether it's some existential sense of needing to know that has brought us to practice. But we stick it out regardless and keep plowing along, sometimes very easily and other times with greater difficulty. And even though it may seem like we are not progressing in our practice, as long as we keep working at it, we are. And we're the last person to know. The teacher can see very clearly where we are at, but so we are so caught often, usually, in our stuff that we're still not seeing clearly enough to know where we're really at practice-wise. At any rate, Flora got more and more and more and more absorbed in this question. Somehow she managed to get good enough grades that she eventually qualified to go for a PhD in psychology. She finally decided that that was probably the avenue she needed to pursue. Well, in the end, she was, by that time, I think, in her master's program. She was home on vacation, sitting on the edge of her bed in her bedroom, glanced at her desk, and the world, as she wrote, turned on its axis. And she had a very, very deep awakening experience. This, from no knowledge of Buddhism, she hadn't even heard about Buddhism back then. This is 1929 and further. And so she changed her advanced degree to a master's degree. Her whole life changed. She found herself profoundly relaxed, able to live fully with ease. Her education was simple and easy. Her life was without trouble, without edge, without challenge, because of this profound opening she had had. And eventually she married, had a son, and moved to Southern California. There she was part of the sort of living room group of Alan Watts. And suddenly one day she began to realize that this so-called enlightenment thing that they were talking about all the time was what had happened to her. She had resolved after it happened and after she tried to explain it to some people that she would never talk about it again until she met somebody who truly could understand. And from Alan Watts' living room, she ended up in the basement of a church in LA where young Maizumi, who was then sensei, was teaching Zen practice. And she practiced the whole entire curriculum with him. She did all the koans, and he eventually asked her to teach, which she declined. But about 20 years after she had had that experience, she was asked by Maizumi to drive a visiting couple of priests up to Tassajara, up in northern California. And it turns out that one of those visiting priests happened to be Yasutani Roshi. And so she did drive. She was actually older than, at that point, she was in her 40s, and older than the usual students at ZCLA, but she was still a dedicated student. And so she drove the priests up there, Maizumi translating, and then drove them, she doesn't talk about whether she drove them back or not. At any rate, she decided to ask Yasutani Roshi through Maizumi, translating, about that experience that she had had. And so she did. And Yasutani Roshi wrote that it was still so alive for her, which says something about the depth of it. 20 years later, it was still so alive for her, and she was living so clearly out of it that, I mean, out of it in the usual sense of the term, not out of it in the sense of being out of it, but she was clearly living from that mind of clarity that she had opened to so long ago, that Yasutani Roshi didn't feel he needed even to test her, to confirm that. There are testing questions in Zen practice, that because Kensho can masquerade in many forms, plus there's a lot of things can appear as Kensho and they're not really. They're just what we would call makyo. And this is another reason why it's so important to have a teacher to discern what's really going on with you. So this is what happened, and we know about it because Yasutani Roshi asked her to write about it. And there was a little book many, many, many years ago called An Experience of Enlightenment. It was published by Quest Books. And then it went out of print. And it was out of print for quite a long time. And when I returned from living and training at Sogenji, I got in touch with Flora because the Rochester Zen Center was willing to republish that little booklet. It was so inspiring to people. And as it turns out, there were other irons in that fire, and Rochester never did republish it. But eventually, after she died, she willed the manuscript to ZCLA, and ZCLA ended up incorporating it in a new edition of, I think it's called Hazy Moon of Enlightenment. So if you go on Amazon.com or otherwise Google Flora Courtois, you will probably come up with that book, and you can read the entire account, which I've only given you a synopsis of. And if it's like it was for me, it's deeply inspiring. So she had a deep awakening experience without any prior education, any structure for it to be put into. And there are people that have had spontaneous awakening experiences. Jacques Lucerin had one in Buchenwald. There are accounts of enlightenment experiences in the Russian Gulag. In those cases, people were pushed right to the edge, and they had a choice actually had several choices. They could die, and people have done that to get out of situations. They could have gone crazy, and people have done that as well. Or they could reach a different way of seeing, and that brought about awakening. So now, let's share some non-Buddhist writings. The first being from the Upanishads, which predated Buddhism in India, but share a lot with the teachings of Buddhism. The self with a capital S is one. This is distinct from the self-image, which is a small s, and which is our, in a certain way, our nemesis. The self is one, unmoving. It moves faster than the mind. The senses lag, but self runs ahead. Unmoving, it outruns pursuit. Out of self comes the breath that is the life of all things. Unmoving, it moves, is far away yet near, within all and outside all. Of a certainty, the person who can see all creatures in themselves, himself in all creatures, knows no sorrow. This is a key note. Of a certainty, the person who can see all creatures in themselves, themselves in all creatures, knows no sorrow. Hakuin wrote in the Song of Zazen, there's nothing outside of, nothing we lack. Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land of this very body, the body of Buddha. This one right here. What is sitting on the cushion or the chair in the zendo, every single one of you, is the body of Buddha. There's nothing outside us. There's nothing we lack. However, how can a wise person, knowing the unity of life, seeing all creatures in themselves, be deluded or sorrowful? The self is everywhere, without a body, without a shape, whole, pure, wise, all-knowing, far-shining, self-depending, all-transcending, in the internal procession assigning to every period its proper duty. And then this out of the Bible. And he said, go and stand on the mountain before the unnameable. And behold, the unnameable passed by, and a great wind tore the mountains and shattered the rocks. But the unnameable was not in the wind, and after the wind, an earthquake. But the unnameable was not in the earthquake, and after the earthquake, a fire. But the unnameable was not in the fire, and after the fire, a still, small voice. And that is exactly what we want to open to within ourselves, this still, small voice. Listen to it, hear it, and we hear it with, not with our ears, but we hear it. It will not lead us astray. And when we become clear enough in our mind state, let go enough of our habit patterns, we are able to perceive that still small voice. It also says in the Bible, I have put my truth in your innermost mind, and I have written it in your heart. No longer does a person need to teach his brother about God, for all of you know me, from the most ignorant to the most learned, from the poorest to the most powerful. And the only thing with that particular reading is that God is not outside us. There's nothing outside of us, nothing we lack. Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. We just have to let go enough of our sticky places that we are able to see it clearly. Drop deep down within. Let the thoughts go by like clouds if they're there. Don't engage in them in any way, not pushing them away and not entertaining involvement with them. Sink deep into your aura and wait increasingly clearly. Through this wondrous extended out-breath, which makes all the difference in the world and shortcuts the practice incredibly effectively. I think that's enough for today. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. I thank you for listening.